Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. In the studio with me, my good friend Lisa Arnone and Julian Joyello with us as well. Have a very interesting subject today. I had a call from a friend, a woman, who was a client, and she said to me that she suddenly felt this enormous depression when she and her husband, who were divorced, finalized the divorce when he took the stuff out of the house. Now, she wanted this divorce. She wanted out of the marriage. Turned out he had been deceptive financially, and she thought that the guy he wasn't. Or maybe the guy he made himself to be was different than she understood. However, when he left, she fell into the deepest depression. When he cleaned out his office, when he took away his furniture, she fell into this depression, and she called me and she said, I don't know why I'm so depressed. This is what I was waiting for. I was waiting for the time when he would finally leave and be cleaned out of the place. I know this woman, and I said to her, I said, you know, you suffered many years ago from a very serious loss when your father died. You had a very close relationship with him. He died suddenly, and it racked you. It was a horrible death to you. She affirmed that it was really terrible. How soon after that did you meet your husband? And she said, well, just about that time I met him. We started dating. And I said, and how was he relative to your being, your handling, your grieving? And she said, he was terrific. He was my support. He was wonderful. I felt completely connected. And then we got married. And then after a number of years, you know, her father is always on her mind in some way. She still talks to him every now and then, even though he's not here any longer. And she said, but, you know, my husband was my mainstay. Now my husband is gone. She says, why do I feel such grief? And I said, because Lisa, Lisa's not her name. I said, because this is what we know about transitional people and objects. It's a very interesting phenomenon in psychology. When something is to replace the pain of something else, when something buffers it, when something cushions the blow, it is not until that thing is gone that you feel the original blow. For example, you're a young person and you have a puppy, a dog that dies. What do? They get you another dog right away. Usually they run out and they buy you a puppy. Why did they do that? To cushion the blow of the loss of your dog. So instead of going through the pain of the loss of your dog, now you have this puppy in your hands, and that supposedly the joy of the puppy lifts your heart. But when the second puppy dies, if there is no puppy, you grieve the first one as well. More important than that, when someone gets a dog and the dog means that much to them in early childhood, it usually means that there's a parent who wasn't available. Why do you love your dog so much? Because there's no father or mother who you could love equally. So when you're so attached to your dog, it really is a substitute for the loss of your parent. But rather than deal with that, hard to do as a kid, you get this dog who replaces it. When that dog dies, you're threatened with the feelings about the original loss. Mom and daddy weren't there. So then when that dog dies, somebody gets you another puppy. Now you're two steps removed from the pain. So after a while, when both dogs die, you're facing the original pain. Any of you who have ever had severe, prolonged relationship grief, you can find some connection to a transitional grief. They talk about people being married on the rebound or picking up relationships on the rebound. What does that mean? That means the first pain was so big that when you stepped in, you interfered with the pain and you became the reboundee. See, you're the one who's carrying the load. Now, if you lose your rebounder, you lose your cushion, you're going to face the original pain. This is Armand DeMille with Lisa Arnone. This is a well-known psychological phenomena called transitional objects and transitional people. It's people we put in the middle to help us cushion the pain and the blows of the original pain, the enormity of the original pain very often. And in this case with the woman who called me, it was her father. Her father had died. She sits in her home. Now listen to this. While her soon-to-be ex-husband is leaving, she turns to him and feels this enormous impulse to say to him, maybe we should go to counseling. Well, she wanted to get rid of him all the time. Now, maybe we should go to counseling, because what she's saying, I would rather prolong this relationship with you through an act of psychotherapy counseling than face the pain that's facing me as soon as you leave this house. People are interesting, aren't they? Aren't people fascinating? Transitional objects are very important. I remember something. There was a talk about Adolf Hitler. Mein Kampf. One of the lessons in Mein Kampf, this came from EST. Let me make the connection between what I'm talking about. EST, Earhart Seminar Training. EST used to be this old training that people would go through to, and they would go there and they would learn something, and then they would get initiated, and then they would suddenly go on to more programs and more programs. And it was all about self-actualization, but it was kind of a Ponzi thing. It was going to be more and more people involved. EST wasn't bad. It just was a thing, okay? However, when you went to EST, they had the most, when they asked you to sign your name and address, they had these very beautiful pens. And these pens said EST, Earhart Seminar Training, towards a new form of knowledge, or something like that was written on the pen. And so people would go and they say, I'm not going to sign up. I know they're going to hoodwink me, but I'm going to steal the pen. And people would take the pens. The pens were retractable. So retractable ballpoints. So people stole the pen. Somewhere in there, I heard, it was a plan to let you steal the pen, because if you steal the pen, you're carrying the name of the company with you everywhere you go. This was originally recommended in Mein Kampf. Adolf Hitler was always recommending, let people steal, because then they are indebted to us. If people steal from you, they're indebted. I knew a man who used to bring his car in for repair, and he would always bring his car in to repair to a place that he knew charged him 20% more. When I asked him, why do you bring your car to that place? He said, because they're so guilty towards me for charging me 20% more that they give me more than 20% service. Although they keep telling me it's all right. So this is Armand DeMille with you. We're talking about transitional objects. There are things that you're attached to in your life that you don't know you're attached to. There are things that you could be attached. It could be an article of clothing. Could be a song. Now, what are people's, as people turn to be 50 or 60 years old, you ask them what their favorite music is, what do you think they usually select? They usually select the music of their adolescence. Music of their adolescence specifically. Well, why the music of your adolescence? Some people might choose Sinatra. They might choose something like that, not necessarily their adolescence. The music that you choose as your favorite music represents one of two things. Either a connection to a parent. Very often a young woman will choose music that she listened to with her daddy. Frank Sinatra, very popular. Or it will represent a state of being, a felt sense of being. a sense of freedom that you remember. And most of us remember in our adolescence, feeling a sense of wilder oats, energy, drive, freedom, that you didn't feel since as you took on the burdens of life. So in this case, the transitional object becomes the music itself. The music represents the thing we're looking for. It's not the thing we're looking for. It represents the thing we're looking for. The connection with our fathers, the connections with our family, the connections with the freedom of moving about.
When you were talking about transitional objects in terms of relationships, my question is, does that put an undue burden on the relationship? Is that relationship destined to fail because of the weight of everything it's carrying? When you talk about music, I think, yeah, that works. You want to have that feeling? I want to have that feeling. I listen to music from my teen years, and I feel better, and I don't worry that that doesn't work. That works. So,
well, let's take the first part. Can the relationship work? Yes, I believe all relationships are false. I think they're all based on some false premise originally. Either it's a replacement object, either it's a symbolic object. It's finding a plus for your minus. If you don't feel good in a certain kind of way, you find somebody who makes you feel good in that way. When you get through the honeymoon period, right? When you get through the fantasy of, oh, it's all I want to do is spend my time laying in bed with you and do nothing else with the rest of my life. Once you get past that, then the illusions all fade away. And then in that period, you get a chance to see. I saw a young woman earlier today who said to me, I have this relationship with this man who was, we had a strong sexual relationship. Now he wants to be friends. No, we had a strong friendship. Now he wants it to be a sexual relationship. She said, but I'm afraid this sexual relationship is not going to work. She said, I'm afraid it's not going to work because I just don't feel it chemically towards him. I don't like the way he particularly smells. His sweat doesn't attract me, you know. She says, and that's usually fairly good. She said, what would we do? And I said to her, look, so you'll find some other compartment for your relationship. If you have a strong friendship to date to start with, and then you find you have a mediocre sexuality together, then there'll be a new container for it. There'll be one that says, okay, we'll do this sometimes and this sometimes. That anything can work out if the two of you are still looking to make the adjustments. It's only when you're trying to force something to fit a particular structure, when you're trying to force a relationship to work a certain way. Like, I want to believe that you are honest with me. A man could say to a new woman he meets because he felt like he was deceived by his last relationship, or vice versa. And then he says to the woman, I want you, and then he tests her over and over again. But he happened to choose somebody who's passive aggressive. Okay, now here I am choosing somebody who is a nice person. As we know about passive aggressive people, they're very nice. They're very sweet. They don't get angry. They are passively angry. And then he has an event with her where she's offended. But since she can't talk for herself, since she's not able to express herself, since she doesn't, she buries the anger inside like she normally does, and she stays sweet. That day, the dog eats her telephone. This is my new excuse for people who don't answer their phones on purpose, right? They have a reason why the dog ate my homework. No, the dog ate my telephone. My telephone, that day he couldn't reach her all day. And she was there dissing him, right? Or turning off her phone or forgetting to turn on her phone as her way of getting back at him. Could that relationship ever work? Could it ever work that she sees I was really angry with him? That was the way, because, you know, she's passive aggressive. She's going to deny it. She's going to say, no, it really was the phone and the battery. And, oh, yes, the other phone in my house also broke. Yeah, oh, no. And just excuse upon excuse upon excuse. But he chose this relationship. If it is important to him to have somebody who is nice and never gets angry at him, then he's going to be stuck, not able to change that into something positive. But if you're flexible, if your love is flexible, and if you're willing to swing with it in some way with any of the new stuff, changes can take place, and you can open to new kinds of relationships. Something new, something different. Now, as to the music, because it works, it's not good enough. Because it works, it's not good enough as far as my idea of how we develop ourselves. If I find myself, I remember it was recently listening to, I asked this wonderful question. Here's a question I'm going to ask. I was asking one of my close friends. Tell me the 5 most poignant moments of your life. What a wonderful thought. The 5 most poignant moments of your life. And she was a traveler. She talked about being in Africa one day and sitting in front of a pond and a herd of elephants come by and they're drinking water where she's drinking water. And she talks about the enormity of this situation. And then she talked about another experience that she had in another bit of her travels. And she talked about sailing. The 5 biggest events of your life. Now, every one of the 5 biggest events of your life are also transitional. They're also a key to your inner need. My 5 experiences included 3 that were drug-induced in my teenage years. I remember, oh my God, and how was this? So I went back and I thought about them, and I don't think about the fact that I have to go back to the Grand Canyon, you know, and drop psychedelics. And and I watched an eagle soar down over my head as being one of my great moments. What I have to do is find that spot inside myself, without the psychedelics, without Grand Canyon, without the eagle. Just like that, relationships can evolve by examining what seems to be the perfect formula and saying, what am I getting out of this perfect formula? What do I need out of this perfect formula? So I think, Lisa, what you're saying is, yes, if it works, don't shake it. No, not necessarily so. If it works, it's a great way to find out about yourself. Even more, you're not going to lose it. You're not going to lose your love of the music.
No, so the music works, and I go in and out of it, there are times when it's more important and times when it's less important. The relationship part is really interesting and challenging to me because it seems you need to be with someone really special, flexible, open in order to be able to deal with what comes up after that initial period and after, you know, with the weight of there being a transitional object, a thing that's buffering against loss, other loss. So that's the part that just seems really challenging and hard and makes me, you know, take pause. What's my question?
What's my question? Another interesting thing that happens with transitional objects is, you know, even this radio station, even me, Armand DeMille, I could be, to you, a transitional object. You know, I could be that voice, the good daddy in the sky. I could be the guy you're listening to. The program, the positive mind could be one that is just essential to you. If for some reason you don't hear me on the air for some time and you say, oh, what happened to it? Oh, what am I missing? You're missing this thing that most of you are enjoying, just as I miss your audience ears, you know?
Yes, I always think of this show as such a comfort to people, as it was to me. And so that comfort is connected, like you said, to other experiences of comfort that are gone by.
So what would be the most significant events in each of your lives if you were to say there were 5 chief moments? 5 chief moments, 5 top moments that you can remember. Can you remember one? Can you pick one? Do you remember one fantastic moment of your life?
Yeah,
you I remember do. One, Julian? Can you pick a peak experience?
Yeah.
I need you. What would you say? Just pick one.
It wasn't. It was a very bittersweet moment for me. It was my freshman year of college. And now I'm in New York City and I grew up here, so my father actually lives here too. But for that first year, and by the end of it, I felt like I had left home anyways. And I called my father because I had a meeting with one of my teachers, and I realized how much he mattered to me. And it was a weird moment, and I couldn't like control myself emotionally at all. And it was like an explosive emotional moment for me. And so I just called my father, and I was like, I love you so much, and I want you to know that I appreciate you. And it was just, I needed to say that, and I felt bad for not appreciating more in the past, but it didn't matter really, and it just...
But you remember that moment to this
yes,
day.
Yes, for sure, yeah. It was a...
You remember just, the moment of that admission to yourself, of the connection yeah. that you had with your dad.
Yeah.
It was a beautiful man.
It was. It was, and he is. And it was a pretty amazing moment for me. And I think since then, I've learned a lot about myself and just being aware of people and how they affect your lives. And yeah.
Good thing. Do you remember a peak moment of your life?
Yes, I do. Mine's also to do with my dad.
Oh, interesting, isn't it?
I was in high school. I had a French class, and we used to get recipes to make at home. So I made this recipe. I made this dish that is not anything we would ever have eaten for the family. And it was probably the first time I really cooked a meal for my family. I probably was about 15 or 16, a whole meal. And when we started to eat it, my father had his first bite, and then he said to me, "Those little hands made this food." Mm-hmm. And he wanted to, like, he was holding my hand and saying, "Those hands made this food. This is so good." And I felt so cherished in a way that went right through me. Like, he saw me and he appreciated me. And I think of that moment so many times in my life as a singular moment of feeling loved in a really pure way.
Okay, now good. So now can we take it apart?
Yeah.
So here's the chance that someone like you would say, oh, I don't want to lose that moment. But let's take that apart for a moment. The reason why the impact was so strong was because you were unsure of that part of him. You were unsure that he loved you to that level. So when you got a validation at that moment, you said, ah, there it is. So that moment, a little like Julian's moment, was a bittersweet moment as well. It was perfect. But it meant all the years before that, or all the time before it, you just didn't feel that solid kind of sureness. Does that make any sense to you?
It does. I also think, like Julian, it's also about your ability to perceive it, you know, to be able to take it in. And there was something about his words, his, you know, act, and my ability to, like, crystallize. It crystallized something, like what Julian talked about, too, that maybe before then I didn't know in words, you know, that I didn't know in a definite way. Was more like a feeling.
Could we say, is it okay to say, they didn't let you know in a definite way? You see, this is where the defense wants to come in. Yes, maybe somehow your dad, Julian, didn't let you know, even though he was always telling you how much he loved you and all that stuff. Maybe he didn't really get it to you, or maybe he didn't understand how much he meant to you. That those moments that crystallize it are also moments showing us, yes, there was a need, and the need was gratified. And that becomes one of those moments in life.
Yes.
That will stay with us forever. See, you won't lose that moment of those precious hands.
Mm-mm.
You'll never lose that moment. But you'll also see, ah, and what took place before then along your roads of travel as you travel through life and see where that goes. So each of us have these transitional moments, transitional objects. Think about something around your house, something that you keep in your house that makes no sense for it being there. It's just a thing. It might be in the closet somewhere. It might be something that you have. It may be a piece of furniture. It may be something. I had a photograph hanging in my living room for the longest time that someone asked me about and said, what is that doing there? Because it did not fit with the decor of the apartment. And I, well, what do you mean, what's it doing there? It's beautiful. It's there, until I questioned it. And when I questioned it, suddenly I released it. I said, of course, I don't need this here anymore. I don't need it here at all. Because it was looking underneath it and trying to find what's underneath it that sometimes frees you in so many ways. Does that mean you should analyze everything and you should intellectualize everything and that you should go through everything to take it apart and take away its beauty? No, but you could explore the beauty itself. You could explore the aha. And in it, you could find such great information about you, about where you were, about where you are, and about where you need to go. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you with Lisa Arnone and Julian Gioiello. We are here with the Positive Mind in a very interesting time of the WBAI station's formation. We're talking about transitional objects, and we're talking about transitional people, and we're talking about transitional jobs, things that we do in the middle that are meant to take care of or cure something from the past. As you examine your life, when you find yourself in relationships, like relationships with friends, people will say to you, what are you doing with that friend? That friend is a transitional friend. That friend represents something. You could have somebody who makes no sense to anyone else. And if you have a friend who makes no sense to anyone else, that friend is going to be absolutely represent some frailty or some part of your life that needs your attention eventually, not necessarily now. Tons of friends like that, right? Friends that you just don't understand why you're there. Hey, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll continue with our discussion.
This is listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, bringing you news, information, and programming meant to empower you. We need your support. If you go to our website, wbai.org, and press the donate button, for as little as $10 a month, you can become a sustaining member. You'll be making a tax-deductible contribution that helps us help you by bringing you truth in radio.
I can stand a little rain. I can stand a little rain. Stand a little rain. Ooh, I can stand.
Armand DeMille back with you.
Let's talk about sensitive people, and let's talk about compassionate people.
A person who is sensitive has antenna. The antenna are sharp antenna that are out there, and they feel things. You know, some people feel more than others. Last week, we did a show on people who are not very sensitive. We call them alexithymias. The alexithymia is this kind of sense where your body goes dull and your mind goes dull and you don't feel very much. That's a person who's not sensitive. Let's not use the word insensitive. The people who don't sense much are numb. The people who sense a lot are sensitive. There are two questions. Are you sensitive? Do you feel a lot? Do you feel a lot of stuff easily? If you do, what is it that you feel? So that's one question about being sensitive. Do you feel so much that you're always reacting to things? If you see a movie, do you cry? If you see someone in the street, does it hurt you? Are you the kind of person who is what they call thin-skinned? Is that bad? Do people tell you you're being too sensitive just because you get upset by things or touched by things? Well, I think not. I think being sensitive is a wonderful thing. It means you feel more. You are more capable of love than the person who feels less, more capable of profound feelings, more perceptive to beauty, and you feel more pain and things hurt more. So it's not a bad thing to be sensitive. It's kind of a wonderful state of being, and it's a wonderful state of being if only we didn't have a world that was so rough, because sensitive people get bruised easily all the time. Now, luckily, when you have sensitive people around, you usually have somebody around who's protecting them and wants to protect them. You have somebody around who says, you know, let me kind of take care of you in some way. Let me kind of help you out with this. Because they tend to attract people who are not so sensitive, but who are good caretakers. So being sensitive, and you might be, it's not a condition. It's a state of being. There are some sensitive folks, and there are other folks who are not so sensitive. Nobody's wrong. Then there's this other meaning of the word, to be sensitive to others. What does that mean? What does it mean to be sensitive to someone? And I think in that case, we're talking about being compassionate, or the part of it I want to address is compassionate. Because if you're paranoid, you're sensitive to other people. You know, I mean, if you're paranoid, you think people, you're so sensitive that you think people are talking about you when they're really not. Or if anybody has a little nuance of a dissatisfaction, you think it's aimed at you. That's a different sensitivity to other people. That's still being a sensitive person. But are you sensitive to someone else's feelings, meaning compassionate? Can you get what the other person is feeling? That's the primary thing I want to address today. This is Armand DeMille here on WBAI with you every Wednesday at 1 p.m., covering different subjects, things that are meant to help you lead a more positively minded life. Back to this issue. Are you sensitive to the people around you? Have you been accused of being, you're not sensitive enough. I'll tell a story. A man comes in to see me, right, for a consultation, comes in and says, here's the story. My wife, her father is dying. I'm losing my job. My dog died a couple of weeks ago. I have lost my best friend, too. And I feel very despairing. Says, now my wife comes to me and says, this is a time when my dad is dying and you're being very insensitive. I want you to be more sensitive. See, that's a typical problem that men run into a great deal of the time, or people run into a great deal of the time, because how could you be sensitive when you're so hurting yourself? And if you are sensitive, you know, just trying to take on that additional burden may crack you. So you actually get angry at the other person for having a problem of any kind, including something as severe as, you know, your dad's dying, which could be pretty severe. But is he wrong? Does it mean the end of a relationship? Does it mean they should break up? Should she say this insensitive cuss, you know, he's no good and I want to have somebody who's more sensitive? I think we have different stuff available at different times for people. There are times that we could be there for people, and there are times we can't. Now, being there for someone and being compassionate requires quite a few things, and it certainly requires that you leave out a few items. So maybe this would be of help to you. you have to ask yourself, are you, and this is for the people who want to be more sensitive to other people, how are you invested in whatever this person is saying? There are three things that I know get in the way of sensitivity: fear, jealousy, and judgment. If a person comes to you to tell you about something that's going on for them, is if you're a frightened person and you're afraid you might lose them, let's say you have a friend, and let's say your friend says to you, I was just offered a job to go work in India. Now, that could be an exciting thing, and he would love to hear you say something like, well, gee, that sounds exciting, tell me more about it. But you might be afraid of losing your friend. So that might happen so quick that your first response is, well, yeah, but there's a lot of disease in India, right? That's not being compassionate. In fact, that looks pretty insensitive. Your friend gets, oh, I'm sorry I even mentioned it. So there's always, whenever there's a harsh response to somebody telling you something or a response that sounds counter to their mood, it's usually a result of some kind of fear that the person who's being told the story is feeling, but they're not aware of it. So if you're a mother and your daughter comes to you and says, oh, I'm going out with the girls and we're going to be out dancing and we'll be out till 2 o'clock in the morning. And you're afraid. You're afraid because you don't know where your daughter's going to be and you don't want to separate from her. You don't want her to really grow up all on her own, and you're afraid she's going to get sexually involved and pregnant or diseased or something. You have all those fears that mothers go through. And so you say, is it a safe neighborhood? First thing you say, instead of sharing the excitement of your daughter going out to a dance. The second thing that happens is jealousy. Now, jealousy has a big part in people's judgment. If a person says something to you about they found a new friend, sometimes you feel like you may lose them yourself, so you get jealous. You say, well, that's not such a good friend. You know, did you ever notice that he has 3 earlobes? Our friends have told me things about him. Or, you know, well, yeah, but what I heard about him is that he's blah, 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 blah. So a second thing that happens is a kind of possessive jealousy that it's so fast and so automatic, you can't even tell it's going on. And you kind of turn around to someone and you say, why did I say that, you think to yourself? Why did I say it? But you're already caught in the loop, and they're already mad at you, and they already start defending themselves, and you already keep going back at them. You get caught in that loop. So you got to kind of wait. When someone comes to you with information, you got to watch those responses, because behind those responses is this quick reaction. The third most destructive thing to being compassionate is judgment. Do you evaluate your friend's mood and what they're getting involved in? If someone comes to you, if you got a husband or a wife or a boyfriend or a girlfriend, and they come to you with something that excites them, something they care about, can you say to yourself, look at how excited they are or how much they care about this, and don't evaluate it? Don't say, is it good or is it bad? But more or less pick up on their feeling. Most of us who have been around a long time get to a point where we get used to people coming to us with information and we wind up giving advice. If you're an advice giver in general, if that's your role in life, if you're the manager of a head of an organization, or you've gotten to a point where people come to you in general, you're always looking for a problem of some kind. If someone comes to you with something, your first thought is this a problem? How's it going to be solved? How do I get rid of it? If this problem's going to be added to my life, how do I dispose of it quickly? So the person who loves you the most comes to you and says to you, oh, I'm the taxes. And you, right away, you're going to get rid of the problem. So the thing you say is, well, we'll call the accountant. Not, gee, you're overwhelmed. I could see that this is really hurting you. Or I could see this is really causing you a lot of pain. So my suggestion on how to be compassionate is, do not give advice. Watch for quick advice. Don't give quick advice. It's useless. It doesn't mean anything. It's not what the person wants. They want to know that you can feel what they feel, understand what they feel, and kind of be there with them, walk with them, step in their shoes, care about them. That's what therapists do. That's what people in my profession do. We kind of let the person know, we understand you. I understand you. If you wonder, those of you who've listened to my show over and over again, how does he know this stuff about people? How does he get so far in with people? How does he get to walk with them at such a tight level? It's because the question I'm asking myself is, what's this person's experience of the world? What are they feeling? Not so much the issue and the facts and who's right and who's wrong and who did what to who, not that so much. But what's this person feeling? So if you're in a relationship with someone now, and that person kind of thinks that you're not a person to talk to, see maybe if you could tone yourself down. Slow your responses. Consider that the best response that you could give is to honestly be able to say, I understand what you're feeling. And if you don't understand what they're feeling, ask questions. So if a person says to you something, for example, like, I just had a fight with my boss, you might ask, what does that feel like? You know, what was it like? What's it like for you? How do you feel now? That's a different question than what did you fight about? See, it's a different thing to give advice or to try to get details so that you can decide who's right and who's wrong. That's the sensitivity. That's what we're looking to develop in ourselves and other people want from us. They want us to be with them. They want to be able to join a little bit. They want to have a buddy. They want to have a pal. They want to have a friend. They want to have a love. Reminds me of a poem that I once saw, which was by T.S. Eliot. So I brought it along for you. It was called The Dedication to My Life, My Wife. Dedication to My Life. Dedication to My Wife. It's just a man who wrote a poem dedicating to his wife. He said, to whom I owe the leaping delight that quickens my senses in our waking time, and the rhythm that governs the repose of our sleeping time, the breathing in unison, of lovers whose bodies smell of each other, who think the same thoughts without need of speech, and babble the same speech without need of meaning. No peevish winter shall chill, no sullen tropic sun shall wither the roses in the rose garden, which is ours, and only ours. But this dedication is for others to read. These are private words addressed to you in public. Meaning that there gets a point where you could sense, I think, meaning. There gets a point when you're in a love relationship or a close relationship or a friend relationship where you sense the other person. You sense them. You feel them. And if you don't sense it, you ask the question. And you're not so much advice giving or judging or criticizing. It's kind of ugly to criticize somebody you love. It's kind of ugly to be someone who's like scolding someone you care about. That's not love. If you're scolding them and you're saying to them, you should have done this and you should have done that and why didn't you do this and why didn't you do that, that's not love. That's kind of like being a parent with a child. And it hurts. It hurts on the other side. I know a lot of people are going through tax preparation time. And during this time, two people in a couple have to start putting together their notes and their records. And say, okay, let's see who's got what and who's got that. You can't imagine how much of the, well, why didn't you, and you should have, and didn't you, and you're responsible, and oh my God, why didn't you do this, and you should have done this, and where are those papers, and why didn't you write it down? That's stuff that goes on between two people preparing their taxes. This for the Internal Revenue Service, or we should call it the Infernal Revenue Service, we're going to share this part and break up love for them. So I don't think that's the way to do it. The goal is to have loving relationships in your life, as many of them as you can have. If it doesn't be, if it's not with a lover, it could be with your children. If it's not with your children, it could be with your parents. What you need is compassion. What you need is the ability to go in there and have someone who will be a friend, someone who will share with you some of what they feel, and with someone, and to be with someone with whom you could share what you feel. From Women Who Dance with the Wolves comes this one page, which I want to read to you, about a person and their privacy. If a woman desires to retain all her instincts and to be able to move freely within her psyche, she can reveal her secret or secrets to one trustworthy human being and recount them as many times as necessary. A wound is not usually easily disinfected once and then forgotten, but is tended to and washed several times as it heals. When a secret is finally told, the soul needs more response than, oh really? That's too bad. Or well, life is tough, from both the teller and the listener. The listener has to try not to depreciate the matter, And it is a blessing if the listener is a person who can listen with a full heart and can wince, shiver, and feel a ray of pain across her own heart and not collapse. Part of healing from a secret is to tell it so that the others are moved by it. In this way, a woman begins to recover from shame by receiving the succor and tending she missed during the original trauma. I think that's kind of a profound statement and has a great meaning about what it's like when somebody shares their inner self with you. The very fact that this inner self that's kind of stayed hidden for so long and then they want to open it up and want to bring it to you, that's a gem. It's a jewel. And if you're lucky, you're in the right place where you can actually respond to it and get what it means to the other person. But sometimes you can't. Sometimes you're overwhelmed by your own life. Sometimes it makes you angry. And the best thing you could do is not just sit there and tolerate, but say, I'm not available. I'm sorry. I'm not here right now. I'm sorry. I can't be too concerned with this. I'm sorry. If it's a real love relationship, you'll be forgiven. But being able to be honest with someone is what makes all the difference in the world. Being able to tell them what you're truly feeling at that moment makes all the difference in the world. That's all they want. They want to know they're getting an honest response. If you have the compassionate response available, that's terrific. That's great. That's fabulous. And if you don't, let them know it. Maybe you can't hear. Maybe you're falling asleep while they're talking to you. Hey, honey, you know, I'm sorry. I'd love to listen to what you're saying right now, but I'm so tired. I'm so fatigued. Can we make a date for tomorrow to really talk about this? Can we do that? See, when someone is dishonest with you, it's because they think they would lose something by telling you the truth. In order for you to promote the most honesty in people, you have to reward the truth, no matter how painful it is. So if you're trying to tell somebody something and they act in a dishonest way by placating you or taking you off track or if they're not just giving you an honest response, you gotta reward that honesty when it comes to you. And that includes, I can't hear you right now. I can't be there for you right now. You gotta reward that. That's an act of love. It's much better than the other stuff. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. We're talking about sensitivity and we're talking about compassion. Two difficult things. I'm going to do what I have been promising to do for ages. And this is going to be the poem that we have read on the air a number of times that we've had requests for. So this is called Please Hear What I'm Not Saying, a man's poem, which we've heard recorded before by someone else. I'm reading it to you this time because I have the words. This is about the honesty that's behind what a person is saying. It says, please don't be fooled by me. Don't be fooled by the face I wear. For I wear a mask. I wear 1,000 masks, masks that I'm afraid to take off. And none of them are me. Pretending is an art that's second nature to me. But don't be fooled. For God's sake, don't be fooled. I give you the impression that I, secure, and all that is sunny and unruffled with me, within as well as without, that confidence is my name and coolness my game, that the water's calm and I'm in command, and that I need no one. But don't believe me. Please don't believe me. My surface may be smooth, but my surface is a mask, my ever-varying and ever-concealing mask. Beneath it dwells the real me in confusion, in fear, in aloneness. Beneath lies my smugness, my complacency. But I hide this. I don't want anyone to know it. I panic at the thought of my weakness and fear being exposed. That's why I frantically create a mask to hide behind. A nonchalant, sophisticated facade to help me pretend, to shield me from the glance that knows. But such a glance is precisely my salvation, my only salvation, and I know it. That is, if it's followed by acceptance, if it's followed by love, it's the only thing that can liberate me from myself, from my own self-built prison walls, and from the barriers that I so painstakingly erect. It's the only thing that will assure me of what I can't assure myself, that I'm really worthwhile. But I don't tell you this, I don't dare. I'm afraid to. I'm afraid that your glance will not be followed by acceptance and love. I'm afraid that you'll think less of me and you'll laugh. and your laugh would kill me. I'm afraid that deep down I'm nothing, and that I'm just no good, and that you will see this and reject me. So I play my game, my desperate pretending game, with a facade of assurance without and a trembling child within. And so begins the parade of masks, the glittering but empty parade of masks, and my life becomes a front. I idly chatter to you in the suave tones of surface talk. I tell you everything that's really nothing and nothing of what's everything and what's crying within me. So when I'm through going through my routine, do not be fooled by what I'm saying. Please listen carefully and try to hear what I'm not saying. What I'd like to be able to say. What for survival I need to say, but what I can't say. I dislike hiding, honestly. I dislike the superficial game I'm playing, the superficial phony game. I'm really like to be genuine and spontaneous and me, but you've got to help me. You've got to hold out your hand, even when it's the last thing I seem to want or need. Only you can wipe away my eyes, from my eyes the blank stare of the breathing dead. Only you can call me into aliveness. Each time you're kind, you're gentle and encouraging. Each time you give to understand because you really care, my heart begins to grow wings. Very small wings, very feeble wings, but wings. With your sensitivity and empathy and your power of understanding, you can breathe life into me. I want you to know that. I want you to know how important you are to me. How you can be a creator of the person that is me. If you choose to, please choose to. You alone can break down the wall behind which I tremble. You alone can remove my mask. You alone can release me from my shadow world of panic and uncertainty, from my lonely prison. So do not pass me by. Please don't pass me by. It will not be easy for you. A long conviction of worthlessness builds strong walls. The nearer you approach me, the blinder I may strike back. It's irrational. But despite what the books say about man, I am irrational. I fight against the very things that I cry out for. But I am told that love is stronger than strong walls, and in this lies my hope, my only hope. Please try to beat down those walls with firm hands, but with gentle hands. For a child is very sensitive. Well, it's brought back to you, and it's kind of a potent piece, isn't it? I don't know the author. A while back, Roscoe made a recording of it, which I had played on the air a few times before. And it sounds so real, and it's each person I see and each person I meet when I'm down at my office and people come in for their consultation. You know, and they're basically saying to me, hey, there's a me inside here somewhere, and I don't know where it is. Could you just be gentle with me so I could show you who I am? That's what the people we love are saying to us. Could you just be gentle with me so I could show you who I am?
We're going to have to be going right now, my friends. If you wanted to hear today's program again, you can go to WBAI.org, or you can go to thepositivemind.com, where you'll hear a lot of archives. And you could send an email also to Armand, A-R-M-A-N-D, at thepositivemind.com. I'd love to hear from you and hear your reaction. We're making a lot of changes here. WBAI is moving uptown. And in the process, we'll be starting a fund drive in February, which means that we will be asking you to help us out. Now, The Positive Mind will be put on an unusual schedule. It'll be on for 2 hours every week, two consecutive hours on the first week. It'll be on Tuesday, the second week on Wednesday, the third week on Thursday. You can see the schedule on the website or on Facebook. This is Armand DeMille. It's good to be with you, friends. Stick with us.
Thank you.